Prince Goldilocks, written by Rotrude and read by Eos Rose. Once upon a time, there was a prince who was quite handsome and charming, though some said he was a bit of a prat and a bully. Those who had seen him sometimes called him Goldilocks, not to his face, or they would have had to confront him in a duel, because his hair was golden and shined in the sun. Those who had occasion to look at him, other princes and princesses, dignitaries and even washerwomen, fell in love with him, at least before he opened his mouth and drawled something highly insensitive or offensive. The year Prince Arthur turned 21, he was deemed by his father, King Uther of Camelot, to be of marriageable age. Proposals thus flooded in from all corners of Albion for the good-looking and brave Prince of Camelot. But Uther, diplomatically, would not commit and attempted to stave off all advances. One neighboring king, called Malgwin, however, was determined to win Arthur's hand. This man ruled over Dyfed, and was rich and possibly as handsome as Prince Goldilocks himself. Since he'd heard of Arthur's beauty, although he'd never set eyes on him, the king of Dyfed had decided he'd have the Prince of Camelot for a spouse, which was why and how he decided to send one of his ambassadors, his own court sorcerer of all people, to ask Arthur's hand in marriage on his behalf. "Magic is banned in Camelot. Uther will have me hanged." Merlin, his personal warlock, soon to be made ambassador, protested vehemently. The king of Dyfed sighed. Merlin was useful, resourceful, and very powerful beneath his simple country boy air. Unfortunately, he'd never learned deference or how to check his words in the presence of royalty. If the king hadn't found him, as we have said, useful and entertaining, Merlin would have been packed back to Eildor, his native village, with an order never to return. As it was, the king of Dyfed rolled his eyes, thought of the strategic importance of having Merlin as a weapon on the battlefield, and bit back an exile order to say, "My dear Merlin, you will have to keep your magic a secret then." "I never thought of that," Merlin answered. "Because you've grown used to practicing it freely. But if I remember correctly, such was not the case in your home village, which is why you sought asylum here." Merlin lifted his shoulders a little and nodded. "Well, then you'll have to be as cautious as you were in Eildor," the king pronounced. "Back to business," he added, rubbing his hands a little predatorily. "You'll have to sound the Pendragons and ask for Arthur's hand in my stead. I'm sure that a few compliments and nice words will do the trick. I am rich and handsome, and an alliance between Dyfed and Camelot would benefit both our kingdoms. So you see, Merlin, this is going to be a mere formality, a picnic even. No particular skill required." Merlin opened his mouth to object again. "But I'm not a nobleman, and kings want to parley only with aristocrats, and..." "Enough, Merlin," the king of Dyfed said, his anger burgeoning. "It's going to be very easy. Do as I say. We'll have presents ready for Arthur. I'm sure he'll consent to join me here as soon as the engagement is announced. We're going to be busy, Merlin. I'll have blacksmiths make splendid suits of armor for him and cloaks befitting his rank. Maybe you should also report back as to Prince Arthur's tastes, so that we can find him presents he'll enjoy." Merlin bowed, tripped over himself as he tried to do so, following the moves prescribed in the official Dyfed ceremonial robes, and agreed. "Yes, sire." "Good, Merlin, very good." Important business thus transacted, the king shooed his absent-minded court sorcerer away, hoping Merlin wouldn't damage anything on his way out. A few courtiers did hear Merlin mutter and curse under his breath, But since nothing exploded, and nobody was turned into a toad, frog, bug, or any other slimy animal, they counted themselves lucky as well as safe. Thus Merlin's protest of, "Dispatched to a magic hater's lair," went largely unnoticed. On the morrow, Merlin left on his mission. He'd been given a splendid carriage, very fine horses, and an army of servants at his disposal, so that the people of Camelot would know of Dyfed's prosperity. Merlin had been shocked, especially at the sight of the servants who were to travel with him, for Merlin was a simple lad, and didn't know what to do with such an individual as a valet. Before stepping up into the carriage that would take him into Uther's lands, Merlin felt a hand on his elbow. It was his king, who whispered to him, "Bring Arthur back with you at all costs." The king handed him a jewelry case, evidently meant as a gift for Camelot's golden boy, which Merlin pocketed quickly, and looked at him, as if to say, "Do not fail me." Merlin smiled rather wanly, hoping that Prince Arthur of Camelot would agree to blind nuptials. If he didn't, Merlin probably would not be welcomed back into Dyfed with open arms. Acting around kings, especially whimsical ones, was very difficult, Merlin found, to his chagrin. "Yes, sire," he answered before settling himself on the carriage's purple cushion. "Drive on," the king shouted to the coachman. So Merlin's first diplomatic mission began. 3 days, 5 changes of horses, and 4 stops later, Merlin, tired, nervous, and a little disheveled, arrived at Camelot. He had donned his finest clothes, as his king had suggested. They were part and parcel of the air of pomp that the Dyfed legation was meant to exude. Merlin felt ill at ease, but when the carriage rolled to a stop in Camelot's castle's courtyard, he made a brave face, plastered on the fakest of smiles, and, wishing there would be no accident that might force him to reveal his magic, stepped out and into the light. Assembled before him, Merlin found a crowned man in his late 40s or early 50s, he assumed to be King Uther himself, a gorgeous, dark-haired lady who was stunningly dressed, and a very pretty, curly-haired maid who stood a few steps behind the former. There were other lords and ladies as well, but of the famous blonde head he was here for, there was no trace. Merlin, shaking himself out of his bout of surprised silence, bowed courteously to the king and introduced himself as the ambassador from Dyfed. King Uther laid a gloved hand on Merlin's shoulder, squeezed so much it hurt, smiled like a shark, and looked down on him with a supercilious air before saying, "You are the representative of a great king, and as such you're welcome in Camelot." The tone suggested that if Merlin hadn't been there on business, he wouldn't have been considered at all. "Merlin," he supplied. "Merlin," Uther said levelly. Merlin's lack of titles, the only one he had, court sorcerer, he could not own up to here, had not gone unnoticed. "Merlin," Uther said, "there will be a formal dinner in honor of Dyfed and your errand here. In the meanwhile, might I introduce my ward, the Lady Morgana?" Uther Pendragon extended a hand toward the gorgeous young woman Merlin had first spotted, and led her before Merlin. The Lady Morgana curtsied briefly, lifted her head proudly, gave Merlin the once-over, and, appearing pleased with what she found, smiled a little impudently, and not at all demurely. "It's a pleasure to meet you," she said in a flirty tone. Merlin, not yet used to such fine ladies addressing him directly, as if he counted for something, babbled a few words that might or might not have been, "The pleasure is all mine," To Uther's and his own dismay, he blushed. Very, very unprofessionally. "This is my handmaiden, Guinevere," the Lady Morgana supplied, just as the other pretty girl he'd seen before smiled at Merlin and curtsied nicely. Merlin, very, very unprofessionally again, waved at her. The King of Camelot scowled, displeased, and took back the reins of the conversation. "I'm sorry to say that my son Arthur is out hunting and won't be back till nightfall." To which Merlin thought, "The prat!" He'd deliberately chosen not to be there to welcome his guests. "I'm sure I'll meet him later, then," Merlin covered, already fearing that he'd botched his first mission, what with Arthur not being there and all. "Surely," Uther said coolly, gesturing for one of his servants. "I'm sure you'll want to rest and freshen up after hours in the carriage," Uther commented, giving said carriage the evil eye, as if it did not meet his lofty royal standards. "This is Morris, my son's manservant. He'll lead you to your rooms, which I trust you'll find comfortable." Uther eyeballed Merlin, probably comparing him to the carriage and finding Merlin as wanting as the means of transport. "Thank you," Merlin offered. King Uther inclined his head a little, as if to imply that Merlin didn't deserve too much attention from a royal personage, and left soon after, red cloak billowing showily after him as he climbed the steps that led inside the castle. "Lead the way," Merlin asked of Morris, who signaled for him to follow closely. Tired and angry at all Pendragons, Uther for his condescending air, and Arthur for the bad manners displayed in not turning up to meet an ambassador, Merlin toddled up the steps after the man called Morris. For the first time in a long time, he wished himself back in Aeldor. The banquet was magnificent. Merlin ate too much, drank too much, had fun watching the court gesture perform, and was finally introduced to Prince Arthur of Camelot, who arrived, sweaty and still dressed from the hunt, at some point after the third course, which happened to be pork covered in honeyed sauce. Merlin rose, bowed, and was subjected to the weirdest kind of scrutiny, after which the prince, hands on hips, said, "This can't be an ambassador. His appearance is disreputable, his neckerchief's laughable, and, I'm sorry, but his expression tells me he must not be very bright." Uther coughed. Morgana exclaimed in outraged, "Arthur!" While Merlin, who had not grown up at court, could not refrain from shooting up from his chair and saying, "I'm sorry," and thinking, "Such a prat, but as pretty as they say." Things, as might have been foreseen after that less than auspicious introduction, did not go very well. Not after dinner, and not on the morrow, when Merlin received an invitation from the prince to join him in his quarters, so that the marriage proposal from Dyfed could be discussed. To make a good impression, Merlin had spent an hour, a wasted hour, he wagered, grooming himself. He'd tried to comb his unruly hair into some semblance of order, and then to find some clothes that did not look slovenly or too large on him, with very little success. What he did manage was to get to the prince's room somewhat late. "So, ambassador," Prince Arthur drawled, as he settled comfortably in a high-backed chair that resembled a throne. "I hear you've come to Camelot to plead the case of your king, the sovereign of Dyfed." Thankfully, they were back on track. The Prince of Camelot was not insulting him anymore, but had decided to canvass the topic that had brought Merlin to this magic-unfriendly kingdom. "Yes, my king has, well, you know." "No, I don't," Arthur Pendragon said, wagging an eyebrow. Merlin hated him right then. Of course Arthur knew why Merlin was there. He knew why, and was enjoying the hell out of watching Merlin sweat for it. "But continue," he said, mock politely, waving a hand majestically. "My king proposes an alliance with Camelot, which he wishes to seal with a marriage between you and, well, him. My king is a gracious sovereign and very handsome, and he will respect you and Camelot and, yes, he sends this as a token of his..." Prince Arthur snorted loudly. Merlin shut up. Arthur burst out laughing, and when he had calmed down, an eternity later, it seemed to Merlin, said, "And how can I trust the judgment of a king who would choose you as his representative?" Merlin could have held his peace. Merlin could have inclined his head and accepted Arthur Pendragon's insult, pretending it wasn't as offensive as it obviously was. Merlin could have done either of those two things, or a few others, if he'd been a trained diplomat or a courtier. The fact was, however, that Merlin was none of those things. He was a warlock, and he therefore spluttered, "But you're a right prat!" "You can't address me like that," Arthur shouted, voice pitched somewhat higher than normal. Merlin might have let him know that his screech resembled the one produced by a very young girl, scared by a mouse, but he was too busy turning scarlet himself to use his powers of elocution. "I am the king's son," Arthur stressed. "I'm sorry," Merlin said, pausing for effect. "That would make you a right royal prat." It was Arthur's turn to splutter indignantly. After a few moments, though, his lips curled up as if the prince had found the whole exchange funny. "You're a cheeky one." "I must speak as I find." The prince chuckled warmly, and his eyes danced as he studied Merlin with renewed interest, which made Merlin raise his head to withstand the scrutiny. "Yes, and that's what's so strange about you, Merlin, isn't it?" Merlin nodded and opened his mouth to speak again. He was prevented by Arthur rising from the chair he'd been slumped in and crossing the room to come and stand before him. Arthur circled Merlin like a hawk would when busy flying around its dying prey. The Prince of Camelot leaned in closer, sniffed Merlin's neck, making Merlin jump, and muttered, "You're a terrible ambassador." "That's what they tell me," Merlin acknowledged. "But I'm stubborn, and if you would just listen to me..." Arthur stepped back, but not enough so as to make the scene look respectable and normal. Merlin's stomach twisted in a weird knot, and his heart, a strange, strange organ, started beating faster than was usual or warranted. Perhaps it was Arthur's attitude and the fact that he was invading Merlin's personal space in a way that was two parts scary and one part exciting that made his heart hammer so. "You'd sing your master's praises like a good parrot. I'm sure he made you learn your lines by heart." "He did," Merlin admitted, surprising Arthur. "But you really think I could remember them? Honestly, you could do worse. He's a good king. He's really handsome." Arthur's eyebrows rose again. "And," Merlin continued, though the Prince of Camelot had just seen fit to lay his chin on Merlin's shoulder, causing Merlin to crane his neck awkwardly to maintain eye contact, "he's not old or a crazy tyrant. Just please make my life easy and accept his suit." Arthur straightened and walked around so that he was able to face Merlin. "And I should marry a man I don't know and whom my father doesn't necessarily trust, because it would make your life easier?" "Not very persuasive, Merlin." Arthur hovered, and Merlin ground his teeth, looking for patience to bear this. I didn't mean it like that.
Arthur laughed. I'd sooner marry you, Merlin. Who knows? With all that impudence on your side, you might even be fun in the bed department.
Merlin opened his mouth to say something, but apart from a half-strangled, sibilant hiss, no sound would come out.
Lo, Arthur mocked him. Now he blushes.
Merlin ducked his head, though he was getting angry. He didn't particularly enjoy being made fun of, even less so when the person mocking him was a spoiled, tactless prince who'd called him an idiot.
Right. Instead, you risk losing a good alliance with a strong king to yank my chain.
Arthur's face morphed into a mask of anger. He bent forward to whisper into Merlin's ear,
Do not presume to question my loyalty to Camelot, ever.
It was a growled whisper, very threatening. Merlin tried not to back down, but he kept silent, preferring to swallow and wait for the rest of the angry tirade that was sure to come.
Whom I marry, Arthur in fact continued, is a matter not to be taken lightly. It shall be weighed by myself and my father for a long time before I commit, all in the name of Camelot. So take your lines learnt by heart, your gifts and your flattery, back to Melguin.
Arthur, is all Merlin said then, feeling partly angry and partly sorry for the man upon learning that he clearly, truly loved Camelot, and was thinking of the welfare of his people when he refused Merlin's king. Arthur's eyes grew large and soft. He squeezed Merlin's shoulders once before moving a few steps back.
Return to Dyfed, Merlin, and seek another job. Good try for a beginner, though. Good luck.
Merlin was dismissed soon after, though he feared that there were undercurrents he had not caught, and things about Prince Arthur that he had not understood. Surely the Prince of Camelot was a vain bully. And yet he'd displayed a dose of common sense and interest in the continued well-being of his subjects that was both remarkable and endearing. Merlin came out of the meeting with him feeling like he'd interacted with two different people, the Prat and the good prince. In the next few days, Merlin was not granted another audience with either king or prince. By the end of the month, he realized he would never have an answer to bring back to Melguin. Years could pass before he got one, and while Arthur smirked at him when they bumped into each other in a corridor or on the stairs, not a word was spoken concerning engagements or prospective weddings. When Merlin realized he was dithering, waiting for an answer or a second audience that would never occur, he decided to go back home and face the King of Dyfed, whom he'd surely let down. Still, Merlin doubted anyone could have done better than him. Nobody could easily have changed Camelot's stance on the prince's marriage but Uther Pendragon himself. It was with a heavy heart and a sentiment akin to fear for the future that Merlin made the preparations necessary to travel back to Dyfed. On the morning of his departure, Arthur himself was there to see him off, which was something of an honor, Merlin learned.
Man up, Arthur told him just before Merlin stepped into his carriage. You did the best you could.
It's easy for you to say, Merlin returned. Arthur may have come across as someone more polite than was his wont, especially when addressing a man of lower rank. However, Merlin was sure he'd be facing the reprimand of the century when he got home, however much the prince tried to sugarcoat things for him.
Merlin, Arthur said, slapping Merlin on the back in a gesture that could be read either as teasing or camaraderie. Godspeed.
Merlin smiled. He couldn't help it. Arthur Pendragon was obnoxious, yes, but he did deserve a parting grin. After all, it wasn't his fault if his refusal to marry anyone just yet foiled the King of Dyfed's plans for advancement.
thereby making Merlin's life more difficult and pathetic than it ordinarily was. Besides, when he didn't hate him, Merlin rather liked Camelot's prince, in a perfectly respectable, unromantic way. In Dyfed, things did not go very well for Merlin, but Merlin had known that it would be so from the moment Arthur Pendragon revealed his intentions concerning marriage. What he couldn't have predicted was the exact turn of events. For all his honest efforts, and for all that nobody could have achieved better results, Merlin was confined to the dungeons by a very distraught and enraged King of Dyfed. From what the prison guards told him, Merlin deduced that his king had grown rather fond of the idea of allying himself with a Pendragon, especially one such as Arthur, rumored to be so handsome, and whose prowess had earned renown in all corners of the land. It was scarcely a surprise, then, that upon learning of Merlin's failure, the king grew furious to the point that he would not listen to Merlin's explanations. "He won't marry just yet. Nothing could be done."
"I'm sure something could be done," the king had retorted, a vein on his temple pulsing dangerously.
Merlin had wanted to suggest the monarch calm down and breathe, lest he suffer from a stroke of some kind, but on second thought, Merlin valued his continued survival, so he'd kept this good piece of advice to himself.
"You should have sung my praises, made me appear irresistible, listed the riches of this kingdom, and instead you return with no Arthur and not even an engagement. How is that to be borne?"
"I'm sorry," Merlin had articulated, knowing he'd disappointed his king. He would have protested some more, but his hands were tied. Dyfed was the only kingdom that accepted magic freely, and if he lost his position and was exiled, it was back to Aeldor, where people had become suspicious of him, or it was off to Camelot with him, and the latter was far, far worse.
"At least I hope he said he would consider my proposal?" the king had inquired, brow furrowed, tone solemn.
That had been when Merlin chose the wrong moment to give back the king's gift, the one Arthur had not accepted.
"To the dungeons!" the king had roared.
And that was how Merlin had come to find himself in the dungeons, sad, alone, if you excluded the rat's company, and progressively more angry. In his cell, he had leisure to muse about a lot of different things: his home village, how he missed his mother, his magic and its purpose — he hadn't found one for it yet — along with his current predicament. Thinking of his situation led him to think of Arthur Pendragon. His face, his hands, his infuriating attitude, his superior smirk, and his desire to protect Camelot at all costs. The latter inclined Merlin to think that Arthur was not such a bad person after all. He was certainly your perfectly dashing prince, much more so than Merlin's current overlord, who, as opposed to Arthur Pendragon, never fought to protect his people, spent his time levying taxes, and never rose from his throne if it wasn't to partake in one stately banquet or another. Truth be told, maybe Arthur, for all that he was an obnoxious little prat most of the time, deserved better than the King of Dyfed. During Merlin's stay in Camelot, Arthur had defeated a griffin, a river monster that ate villagers for sport, and a three-headed giant hound that preyed on infants. All in all, Arthur was a bit of a hero, and he wouldn't enjoy the life he would lead in Dyfed, where he wouldn't be able to go on patrol, lead an army, or save damsels in distress. Yes, Arthur would scowl and snort and steal a rope and escape back to Camelot in 2 days flat. Merlin could picture the scowl and Arthur's reaction and... Oh, Merlin thumped his head against his prison's wall. Then he did it again. His brain couldn't get more addled than it was, since he'd already lost all his marbles. He winced, though, and said, "Ouch." He had lost all his marbles because in less than a month he'd fallen in love with a man he'd talked to thrice and had observed from afar, like the pining idiot he was, the rest of the time. Merlin had spent 3 weeks confined in the dungeons when he arrived to this very unwelcome conclusion. He only rejoiced when he realized there was no likelihood he'd see the younger Pendragon again, because he'd rot in here, on his little bed of straw. Well, unless he decided to turn outlaw, magically knock the door that kept him shut here off its hinges, and effect a reckless escape that would have him trailed by guards, dogs, and an enraged King of Dyfed, who'd then proceed to hound down Merlin's mum in Ealdor. Just as Merlin was worrying himself to death with these mental images, he was interrupted by the King of Dyfed himself. He entered Merlin's cell, and once he'd stepped well inside it, scrunched up his nose at the squalor of the place. "I was very disappointed in you, Merlin." Merlin looked up, bit back a curse, and said, "I know, but it couldn't be helped." "Yes, well, I had set my heart upon marrying Arthur Pendragon." Bile rose in Merlin's mouth. He felt a stab of something and swallowed hard. "It wasn't my fault he said no." "I know that now. I needed to calm down to see it," the king explained as he paced up and down. He soon faced about because the cell itself was very cramped. But he did not desist altogether, probably because the king felt very ill at ease in here. "But I did see it in the end. You've been very loyal, Merlin, but such a great disappointment as the one I had to suffer. Anyway, I wish you could have helped me." Merlin felt a momentary pang of guilt. After all, the king's affection was probably somewhat genuine, if inflated. He'd only heard good accounts of Arthur's looks and valor, and he must have grown fond of the idea of him. "You know that I love Arthur Pendragon as much today as when I dispatched you to Camelot," the king continued, as if he were talking to himself. Which maybe he was. "His refusal has not made any difference. I need to convince him that it would be a very good idea to marry me, and yet I don't know how I could change his mind." "I fear Arthur is stubborn, and that further pressing wouldn't persuade him." The King of Dyfed looked angry for a moment. There was a tremendous flash in his eyes that made him look stern, forbidding and dangerous, but that too subsided, and the king said, "I should like to send you again to Camelot on a mission similar to the first. Try everything in your power. I promise you your freedom and my protection, which would naturally extend itself to your dear mother if you were to bring Arthur back here with you." Merlin blinked. The King of Dyfed stopped pacing. "I'm sure that you'll think of something. Besides, another visit to Camelot would be preferable to an unlimited stay in the dungeons." Merlin reflected. He'd given the local rats names, forgotten what day it was, lost a few stone when he was not the type who could afford to lose weight at all, and, more importantly, he'd not written to his mother in so long she was sure to worry. So he would just have to convince Arthur, whom he maybe, perhaps, loved, to marry someone that wasn't him. Harder things were performed daily by the gods of the old religion. After all, Malgwyn had just threatened his mother in a roundabout way, and he could not risk her. "All right," he said as he rose stiffly from his corner. He could barely stand, and his legs wouldn't support him, but at least now he could look forward to some fresh air. Thank you, sire. Merlin set out with his heart in his throat. This time he chose to have no carriage and no servants and to press forward quickly, hoping against hope that having some time to mull things over alone would help him find a solution to his quandary. Thankfully, the weather was nice and the journey was almost enjoyable, if not for the cloud of anxiety that hovered over him. There was the fact that he felt he was not allowed to fail, which made him nervous and caused him to fear for his mother. And then, if Merlin let himself think about it, there was the fact that he had to be mistaken about his feelings. He could not have developed them so rapidly and simply because the Prince of Camelot had teased and, admittedly, flirted a little with him. He was concentrating so hard on the swirl of his thoughts that at first he didn't hear the call of distress. Soon, however, his magical senses began to prickle, and Merlin heard a voice in his head calling for help. Merlin tugged on his mare's reins and convinced her to slow down to a gentle trot. The voice in his head was soft and kind, neither feminine nor masculine.
"Help, Emrys,"
it said. Merlin decided that he needed to find out who it belonged to and how he could rescue the person or magical creature in need. He forced his mare to stand still and looked around. He was riding along a road in the forest, and ahead of him there lay two different paths, the beaten and fresh one that would eventually bring him to Camelot, and a winding and meandering one that also happened to be a little overgrown. If he used his mortal senses, Merlin would never be able to establish where the call for help came from. But if he closed his eyes and concentrated on his powers, he knew he would be able to pinpoint the source. So that's what he did. After a minute or so, he was quite certain that the creature calling out was to be found somewhere to the east. He spurred his horse on to take the path that would take him closer to it, though he was sure he was deviating from the one that would take him to Camelot. After a few more minutes, he found himself in a green and sunny clearing. There in front of him, a wounded horse lay on its side. Merlin dismounted quickly, tied his mare's reins to a sapling branch, and moved slowly to approach the woodland creature. As he got nearer, twigs snapping under his feet, he realized that what had looked like a common horse from a distance was, in truth, a beautiful unicorn. It was breathing too fast, its belly rising and falling unevenly, and a hunter's arrow was embedded in its flank. Merlin hurried to kneel by its side. He petted its forehead gently, trying to soothe it.
Take out the arrow, Emrys.
The voice in his head rang true and clear. What if I hurt you more and you bleed too much? Merlin asked out loud. He still found telepathic communication strange.
This man-made weapon prevents me from healing fully,
the voice explained, just as the animal neighed softly.
If you take it out, my powers will regenerate my torn muscles and skin. Please, Emrys, from one creature of the old religion to the other.
Merlin nodded, squared his jaw, knowing he was about to inflict pain, and did as he was bade, trying to go about it in such a way that would not cause too much agony. He extracted the arrow by pulling swiftly. The iron tip had caused quite a lot of damage that he could see, but soon, by magic, the wound began to close till its margins became only a thin, red, and angry line. The unicorn, which had whinnied when Merlin had tugged on the arrow, shook its tail and sprang back up, evidently feeling restored, though its legs were still shaky.
I thank you, Emrys, for the kindness you bestowed on me. You have saved my life. One day I will repay you.
So saying, the unicorn swished its tail and ambled away,
turning once to rear before him. Merlin took it as a form of a horsey salute and waved back. In no time, the unicorn, the most beautiful creature Merlin had ever had the pleasure to see, was gone. Feeling proud of himself, Merlin clumsily climbed back up on his own saddle and convinced his reluctant mare to head back towards the path that would take them to King Uther's court. Despite the detour, Merlin was surprised to find that he hadn't wasted too much time. Besides, there was a happy unicorn galloping about, which made him happy in turn. He reckoned it must have been some kind of magical solidarity that made him so. Destiny, though, didn't seem to make Merlin want to reach Camelot within a reasonable time frame. The road took him through a small market town that he remembered passing through during his first journey towards Uther's kingdom. Something had changed this time around. Merlin had only seen silent and deserted alleys on that first visit, yet he could now hear raucous laughter coming from the only tavern the town boasted. Fire curled from its chimney, announcing the fact that it was open for business, which it hadn't been the last time Merlin had been by. His stomach rumbled gently at the reminder of food, which was why he got off the saddle and led his horse to the alley nearest the tavern. He prepared to tie her there when he saw something that looked terribly out of place. There was a cage, large enough that a couple of wolves would fit into it, and inside it, a girl of approximately Merlin's age was crouching down, cowering. Her dress, which might have been of a pretty red once, was torn in places, and the girl's face and hands and legs were dirty, as if she hadn't been allowed to wash in a while. Merlin knew instinctively that she was magic and in danger. He didn't scruple to bust open the cage and let the girl, who looked scared and lost, out of it. "I'm Merlin," he reassured her, "and I won't hurt you." The girl did not look convinced, not until Merlin smiled widely and told her that he'd lead her to freedom if she allowed him to. He finally managed to persuade the girl to escape with him. He helped her onto his horse and mounted behind her. Soon they had left the cage and the village far behind. "I'm Freya," she said in a small voice a few hours later. She was still shaking a little in his arms, but it was clear that she had come to trust Merlin at least in part, or she wouldn't have spoken at all. "A bounty hunter captured me," she explained after a while. "He kept me prisoner in that cage so that he could sell me to Uther Pendragon." Merlin felt rage and compassion battle within him. He raged at Uther Pendragon's behavior and felt compassion for the young girl, who was very much like him. "Where shall I take you?" he asked then, wanting to do something nice for her that would make up, in part, for what she'd had to suffer at the bounty hunter's hands. "Home, by the lake," she answered. Thus Merlin took another large detour that cost him 3 days. He led Freya to a beautiful place by a lake. When they arrived, he helped her off his mare, and Freya smiled at him, took his hand in hers, and said, "Merlin, it was very generous of you to rescue me when you might have been captured yourself. I am grateful." Merlin squeezed her hand. He smiled sheepishly, passing a hand through his hair, not knowing how to convey to Freya how much he liked her, and was thoroughly stunned when she kissed him on the cheek. "Someday I will repay you," she vowed, before turning into an awe-inspiring large black animal. Merlin knew Freya would never hurt him, so he patted her between the ears, felt her purr, and, smiling, bid her farewell. Merlin spent the night by a riverbed, warmed by a small campfire before reprising his journey. He'd lost 3 good days, but he did not feel sorry.
He hoped Freya was well and that she would be able to live happily in the lake area she had chosen to dwell in. The morning after, Merlin woke to the sound of wings beating frantically nearby. He rose to inquire and soon found a little creature trapped in a spider's web. It looked like a man, but it could be held in the palm of Merlin's hand. It had wings, and two little horns sprouted from its green-gray forehead.
"And what may you be?" Merlin asked, surprised to find that such creatures existed.
"Thank the gods," the creature exhaled. It looked both frightened and vexed. "I despaired of rescue. How many warlocks able to see a fairy from Avalon could be counted on to pass by in my hour of need?" Merlin didn't reply, for it clearly was a rhetorical question. He shrugged a little and smiled congenially.
"Well, well, warlock, free me before the spinner of this trap comes back and eats me."
"Sure," Merlin said as he scooped the little Avalon fairy up. Once comfortably seated in Merlin's hand, the tiny creature sighed in relief, sneezed on Merlin's skin, which was quite unpleasant, paced to and fro, which tickled, and finally stood still and declared a tad loftily,
"You have done me a great service, warlock. I was caught. In a few minutes I would have perished. The creatures of the old religion know how to be grateful, and one day I will repay you."
That said, the fairy clapped its hands, and a portal to Avalon, magnificent ethereal Avalon, appeared before Merlin's eyes. A myriad of lights danced and sparkled, though it was full daylight. It rained rose and bluebell petals just as the fairy's winged companions appeared to carry Merlin's new little friend away to the airy kingdom beyond worlds. Merlin arrived in Camelot dusty, saddle-sore, and travel-weary a week later. Nothing momentous had befallen him since the day he'd saved the Avalon fairy from a death by spider, and things had settled back to normal. Entering the great courtyard, Merlin's muddied and worn jacket and trousers caught the attention of the most snobbish of courtiers, who turned up their noses and shook their heads as if to say, "What shameful conduct!" Merlin also spotted Arthur at a window. When he recognized Merlin, Arthur smirked down at him, a smirk that some would have called a smile of sorts, tilted his head a little, and laid a hand on the open window pane. Merlin heard him call for his manservant, Morris, after which he soon disappeared. After Merlin's mare, a quadruped that now hated him for having put her through a journey twice as long as the one she remembered, was stabled, Merlin had to go up to the throne room to state the reason of his renewed presence in Camelot. There Uther gazed at him scornfully, though his tone was coldly polite and perfectly measured, and told him that he'd have to speak to Arthur again, but he'd have little hope of achieving anything, for the prince had decided he'd stay a bachelor for a while longer. Merlin retreated from the throne room, feeling down and low. How could things be worse? At least before, both King and Prince of Camelot had lent an ear to the nuptials negotiation, while now Arthur had decided that staying single was the way to go. Merlin was brooding on the way to the rooms appointed to him when he was intercepted by Arthur Pendragon himself. During Merlin's interview with Uther, Arthur had apparently changed. While he had worn a plain blue tunic when he'd leaned out of his window, he was now wearing a fine red doublet and a tunic that looked as if it was made of the finest silk. He had maroon trousers on, and his feet were encased in shiny riding boots that were not as shiny as Arthur's newly washed hair. "Merlin," the prince greeted him, wrapping an arm around Merlin's shoulders as though Merlin were an old and seldom seen friend. "What brings you here?" The friendly behavior was evened out by another superior little smirk, one of those Pendragon was famous for far and wide. Merlin felt like squirming or blushing, but he tried to stay composed.
"Your hand," he blurted out.
The hand, the real one, on his shoulder squeezed tight. Arthur schooled his face into an unreadable expression. He did sidle infinitesimally closer, breathing a little too fast on Merlin's neck.
"Why, Merlin," the prince quipped, voice going low and suggestive, "I hadn't known you liked me that much."
This time Merlin turned crimson, just like the sun at sunset. Only the color didn't look as good on him as it did on canvas.
"On my king's behalf," Merlin specified, coughing out of embarrassment.
Arthur let go of him instantly. He put some space between the two of them. He didn't look directly at Merlin for a full minute, and when he did, there was a cold light in his eyes that Merlin had never had aimed at him before.
He mumbled. "This is my last chance to please my king," he said, revealing far too much. He knew he should have been more discreet. Diplomacy called for silence and mystification. Still, Merlin was no diplomat, and maybe pity for him would convince Arthur to listen to his words when everything else had failed.
"Please," Merlin said, "marry him." Nothing had pained Merlin as much as having to spit out those words, and watching Arthur bristle and close off when he'd been almost open but a few minutes ago. If Merlin had listened to his heart right then, he'd have said, "Marry me." But he couldn't, because he had to think of his mum and the fact that he was magic and a commoner and would be deemed mad for having dared to propose to a prince. Arthur stiffened. His shoulders went rigid and his jaw locked in a way that must have been painful. Merlin hummed, not knowing what to say or do.
"Is that really what you would want?" Arthur inquired. "Me marrying Melgwyn?"
Merlin bobbed his head.
No, he was lying, but it wasn't as if he could help it. In the best of possible worlds, Arthur would stay single forever, and Melgwyn would give up his claims. This was the harsh reality, though, so he said,
"Yes, he's an excellent king. Thinks of his people. He's good-looking and well-read. He's a good person, and..." Merlin had run out of compliments and was racking his brain for a few decent but not over-the-top ones when he heard Arthur say,
"You like and admire your king very much, the way you sing his praises."
Merlin was quick on the uptake.
"Yes, indeed. My king's the best of all, and I'd be the idiot you called me."
Merlin trailed off because Arthur had gasped and opened his mouth like a stranded fish when Merlin had said idiot. Merlin couldn't understand why that was. Arthur was a mysterious individual.
"I might even object to your excluding my father from the best king category, but I'll wave that aside, considering you're not his subject. But since that's your stated opinion," Arthur said in a voice modulated to convey politeness, but which was also strained and cold.
"Merlin," he began again, "the reasons you have given me are very good ones. If a servant..." And Arthur stressed the word servant in a way that made Merlin flinch and abandon all hope of Arthur and him ever becoming friends. "Commends his master as you do, there must be grounds. Servants usually complain about their masters, or they do when they can be sure not to be overheard. Your king is in his castle right now, which should be a proof of your sincerity." Arthur held himself stiffly, full martial air on display as he continued, apparently changing tack. "You must know that a month ago, as I was walking by the river, a signet ring that I was wearing slipped off my finger and splashed into the water.
It's very precious, what with it being used to seal official documents and all. My father still doesn't know that it's gone, and I wouldn't want to listen to his reprimand once he finds out. You may imagine how angry I was at losing it. Let's say I'll listen to your king's proposal of marriage, if you manage to retrieve it. So you know what is expected of you now? Arthur raised an eyebrow and added, You can't leave Camelot till you have it. But why? Merlin asked. Arthur sneered and said nastily, I want to watch you sweat to get it back, Merlin. Merlin's nostrils flared in anger. So, after all, Arthur was indeed a prat. Well, now he knew he had no reason to regret losing him. That was, if you could ever regret losing someone you've never had, and who evidently hated your lowly guts. But of course, you prat, Merlin shouted. I'll get your damned ring back, somehow. Merlin, Arthur retorted. Manners. You'll have to do a little begging and walking on your knees, otherwise I won't be listening. With those parting words, Arthur swaggered away, leaving a fuming Merlin to stare after him. Prat! Merlin shouted after him as Arthur turned a corner and disappeared from view. Merlin ambled along the riverbank, wondering how he could retrieve the signet ring Arthur had lost in its waters. Days had passed, and it was sure to have drifted off somewhere else. Maybe by now it had reached the sea, a sea Merlin had never seen. He weighed his options. Using magic in a kingdom that banned it, sitting and waiting for a miracle to happen, or going back to the castle to tell Arthur he'd given up. Caution won, and Merlin chose option number two. He sat on a boulder and hid his face in his hands. Why did these things happen to him? What do I do now? He moaned out loud, knowing he was alone. He hadn't been waiting for an answer, and he certainly wasn't expecting to see the fairy he'd rescued from that spider's web the other day. Emrys, the little thing chimed, as bells on a spring day. I think you need my help. I said once I would reward you, and here the time has come. What can I do for you? Merlin pinched the bridge of his nose and sighed a little. He doubted the little creature from Avalon could really do something to get him out of his current scrape. Nevertheless, he said, I need to find a lost ring that was dropped into these waters, and I can't use magic because it'd be a crime in this kingdom. What was lost shall be found, the Avalon creature declared. It popped out of sight, and Merlin thought he'd been had. Obviously, there was no way to get back an object that had been cast into the fast-flowing river more than a month ago. No way. The fairy reappeared. It was back, and its little wings were stretching upwards, as if they were trying to support the creature mid-flight, and the upward motion was a strain on their light, delicate structure. The fairy itself was encumbered with a ring. It was as big as a good portion of the little Avalon inhabitant's torso, and must have been hard to carry for such a tiny creature. "Here's your ring, Emrys," the fairy told him. "Consider my debt discharged. And you didn't even have to bat a magical eyelash." That said, the fairy dropped the ring on the palm of Merlin's hand and winked out. Merlin didn't stop to wonder. He gazed at the ring in his hand, which bore the coat of arms of the Pendragons, and the little jewel glinted and shone, not tarnished by its stay in the water. Merlin felt relieved. Having secured the ring in one of his jacket's pockets, he ran back to the castle and, taking the stairs he encountered two at a time, launched himself into Arthur's room without even knocking. He hadn't planned on not knocking, but had just been so enthusiastic about having accomplished his mission that he hadn't remembered that he should. Arthur, who was gazing out the window a little disconsolately for such a busy man, whirled around, hand on the hilt of his sword. Merlin stopped in his tracks and flailed a little. He skidded on the floor and almost lost his balance. Just as he was about to land on his back because of his momentum, Arthur grabbed him by the elbow, wrapped a hand around his waist, and held him. Arthur forced him back upright again by dint of using his muscles in a battle pitched against gravity and Merlin's terrible coordination. When he was mostly vertical again, Merlin realized he was standing too close to Arthur. Since he could feel the prince's every intake of breath against his own heaving chest, he decided they were in a somewhat compromising position, more so given that Arthur hadn't let go of him at all, even though Merlin could now be trusted to stand by himself. Arthur was watching him closely, eyes tracking from Merlin's probably now too wide eyes to his parted lips. This, Merlin believed, was both very, very awkward and very, very exciting. Merlin felt the urge to lean forward a little and brush his lips on the side of the prince's neck. What was he thinking? Of course he shouldn't. Arthur had just started smiling at him in a very silly way when Merlin scrambled back. He bumped into a laden table, but fortunately there were no further accidents, and he broke nothing. Merlin then fumbled in his pockets, and after a little rummaging, he found the ring Arthur had wanted returned. "Here!" he panted, not sure himself whether he was out of breath because he'd run all the way from the river, or because of Arthur's proximity. "Is your ring? There's the Pendragon crest on it, so I'm sure you'll recognize it as yours." He held the ring between his thumb and index finger, so that Arthur could see with his own eyes that Merlin wasn't lying. Arthur's eyes widened. He looked positively flabbergasted, as if he'd not trusted Merlin to find the ring. Well, Merlin evidently wasn't as useless as Arthur Bloody Pendragon thought. "Happy?" Merlin challenged, still thinking Arthur should not have sent him chasing rings. Arthur's face darkened at Merlin's tone, or possibly he was displeased by something else. Merlin couldn't quite put his finger on it, but Arthur had changed completely in the space of a few seconds. When Merlin had burst in, Arthur hadn't appeared angry at all, merely surprised, and when Merlin had almost found himself cartwheeling back, ready to land on his posterior, Arthur had helped him up gently. Arthur Pendragon made no sense. A senile donkey would have been more reasonable. As Merlin so mulled, there came a fierce light in Arthur's eyes that would have frightened Merlin if he thought Arthur knew about his magic. As it was, there was an undecipherable edge to him that unsettled Merlin more than it calmed him. Merlin had, in fact, not been expecting a reward for finding the ring, but a smile would have gone a long way. "Truly, Merlin," Arthur drawled, "you must be the favorite of some fairy, or you could never have found it." How in the name of the old religion had Arthur found out? Merlin paled. He could already see his neck on the chopping block. "Since you are so kind," Arthur continued in a cutting tone, "perhaps you will do me another service. I'm afraid I won't be able to marry anyone at all till this matter has been seen to, for Camelot must always come first with me." Merlin had no idea where Arthur was going with this, but as long as he didn't summon any guards, Merlin was willing to listen. "There is a beast in the sewage system. Our physician Gaius says it's an Afank." "Our physician Gaius says it's an Afank. Now I'd go and slay it, but unfortunately there is another monster that must be put to death first, since it is killing the populace of one of the outlying villages. But the Afank is dangerous, Merlin, so before I can listen to your proposal, you must kill him and bring me proof of its death." Arthur smiled a little cruelly, and Merlin's heart sank.
A monster? He had to kill a mythical monster before Arthur would condescend to listen to his petition. Are you playing with me? Merlin spat out. Irritation was definitely winning over his attraction to Prince Pratt. Scheming, devious bastard. Arthur crossed his muscled warrior arms over his chest and tutted. I need to understand a few things, Merlin.
What things?
I suspect you know. For now, I'm testing your loyalty to your king, and... But I think you'd better go. Dispatch the Afank, Merlin, if you're brave enough.
Merlin left Arthur's ring on the table, turned, and left.
Blasted Pratt.
Merlin decided to proceed cautiously. He could probably dispatch the Afank by himself if he tried, but he'd learned in Dyfed that one had better come prepared when it came to facing magical monsters he hadn't known existed before. Arthur had mentioned a certain Gaius, the court physician, as the one who found out about the monster's unwelcome presence in the sewers. Merlin winded his way to the tower that housed Gaius's workshop to get some basic information about the beast he was going to have to face and destroy. Merlin lost himself amid the castle's corridors and had to backtrack numerous times before gentle Guinevere helped him by escorting him to the desired place.
"Thank you, Guinevere," he said.
"Call me Gwen," Guinevere said. "It's much more practical." Merlin smiled freely for the first time that day.
"Sure, Gwen," he articulated. They were before the physician's door when they parted ways, Gwen to go pick flowers for the Lady Morgana, and Merlin to brainstorm.
"Goodbye, Merlin," Gwen said, tilting her head down and looking at him softly. Merlin was waving enthusiastically, since he was a little flustered, when an old white-haired man opened the door and arched a defiant eyebrow.
"Yes?" he inquired,
seeing Merlin dawdling on his doorstep.
"Hello," Merlin said. "I'm Merlin, and, well, I'm Dyfed's ambassador, and Prince Arthur ordered me to kill an Afank you might have in the sewers."
Merlin blurted this all out quite quickly, wanting to cut to the chase.
"I see," Gaius said, while his eyebrow tried to climb even further up, defying the laws of gravity and muscle flexibility.
"Come inside," the old man invited. Merlin made himself welcome as he took in the surroundings. There were different tables in the workshop, all of them cluttered with pots, jars, and other objects Merlin, in his simple way, could not put a name to. Some foul-smelling potion was brewing in a large cauldron on the hearth. The unpleasant smell was covered by the scent of recently gathered herbs, which were collected in little bowls, or that had been hung to dry in small satchels.
"And how do you propose to kill this creature, young man?" Gaius asked.
Merlin could not confess that he was magical, but he could try to extract some information from Gaius.
"I don't know yet, but Arthur gave me this task, and I need to carry it out. If you could just tell me everything you know about Afanks, you could help me out a lot."
"Prince Arthur wants you to kill the Afank," Merlin sighed.
"It's a long story."
"Well, I don't know how to kill one," the man admitted. Merlin's hopes were shattered.
"However," Gaius continued, moving to search one of his overloaded shelves and picking up a book from it, "I know that Afanks are creatures that can only be summoned by evil sorcerers. They're elemental beings."
Gaius laid the book he'd chosen on one of the tables and motioned for Merlin to come over, so that Merlin could inspect the relevant entry. Merlin read over Gaius's shoulder, humming nervously under his breath.
"What does it all mean?" "Have you ever heard of the theory of elements?"
Merlin shook his head vigorously.
"Nope." "Well, it is said that everything is made up of the four basic elements: earth, fire, air, and water."
"How could that help me?" Merlin wondered aloud as he passed a hand through his already tousled hair. I don't really know, Merlin, Gaius reiterated. I do know, though, that Aphanks are creatures of earth and water. As a consequence...
What?
Well, perhaps the other two elements could harm it, or kill it, Gaius concluded.
Merlin slapped a hand on his forehead and grinned maniacally. Thank you, thank you, thank you, he shouted gleefully, running out of the room.
It's mere speculation, Gaius called after him.
Merlin was already out the door, though, and making his way to the sewers. Finding them was not so difficult. For one, he simply needed to follow the pungent smell. There was an access door that must have been built to allow workers in for repairs, and Merlin slunk inside, unseen. He followed a dark passage till he could no longer see. At once he realized that it would be foolhardy to proceed blindly. He would have preferred not to use magic in Camelot, but it was this or getting lost in the dark in a place where a monster was lurking. Besides, no one was likely to trapeze around here, while he might have been seen in the open. He called Light to him. A blue light spear was summoned into being. It floated up above Merlin's head, illuminating the path before him. It flitted quietly, hovering when Merlin stopped as he tried to get his bearings. There were stairs and more passages to be taken into account down here. Furthermore, this was a drafty, lonely, and dispiriting place. No wonder a monster had taken to inhabiting it. Merlin was well deep within a system of intricate passages when he heard a noise and thought he saw a shadow. He swallowed, braced himself, and marched on. Soon he found himself in a large quadrangular room, still deserted. Still, Merlin could have sworn he'd made out a shape sneaking away. He took a few tentative steps forward towards a large water tank when he heard a decidedly inhuman lament. He spun around quickly, and he found himself facing a huge monster, its jaw snapping at him. Merlin froze for a few seconds, just as the creature emitted a terrible screech and charged him like a bull that had just seen red. He ducked and rolled, trying to get out of the creature's reach. Frantically, Merlin tried to think up spells that would allow him to control fire and air, but his mind was a little bit dumb with shock. He did manage to spit out one that made the creature recede, unsure of how long it would last. Merlin, who was not an idiot, used the respite to scramble back to his feet and think of something. When he turned, he saw a spent torch fixed to a bracket on the wall. He picked it up and darted away just in time to avoid another assault from the irate creature. Merlin scuttled backwards to safety and fixed his attention on the torch, trying to tune out the monster to have the time to think of a spell. When he found one, the torch blazed to life. Merlin brandished it in front of the creature's horrible muzzle and was pleased to find it feared fire. It seemed there was a good chance that Gaius had been right about how to defeat the creature. Betting on that, Merlin advanced, holding the torch aloft. The monster, who was probably not keen on getting killed, lashed at him, but Merlin jumped out of its reach and hid behind his only weapon besides magic, the torch. He received a scratch, but nothing too bad, he knew, because he could overlook the pain that flared up in his right arm. Right then, the Aphank seemed to have decided to have another go at Merlin, just as Merlin equally established that it was either him or the monster. Decision made, he heard a voice suggest a spell in his head. He knew that sibylline, sexless voice. It belonged to the unicorn he had saved. It was reciting to him the spell Merlin would need to defeat the Aphank. "This is my thanks, Emrys," the unicorn whispered to his soul. Merlin repeated the spell aloud and watched as the creature was engulfed by the flames emanating from the torch. It screeched and yowled and tried to escape from the flames licking at its flesh, but all movement soon subsided.
It died slowly, but die it did, leaving Merlin gasping for breath. Exhausted, Merlin crumbled to his knees, which felt like jelly, and laughed hysterically. He hadn't really believed he would make it. As Merlin tried to reconnect with reality and the fact that he'd defeated the Afank, Arthur made his appearance. Like Merlin, he was holding a torch in one hand. In the other, however, he was gripping his sword. "What are you doing here, fool?" Arthur yelled at him.
"Killed the Afank," Merlin said, pointing in the general direction of its charred carcass.
"You could have got yourself killed," Arthur shouted, outraged. Merlin wondered why Arthur wasn't happy he had carried out the mission the prince had entrusted him with.
"Did you stop and think for a minute? Did you? And all that to please your idiot of a king? You must really—"
Arthur had almost run out of words when he perceived the blood staining Merlin's sleeve. It was only when Arthur's stare landed on the tear that Merlin noticed that his shirt had got ripped. The prince was by Merlin's side in a flash. He let his sword clatter down, unheeded, propped the torch he was holding up against the wall, since Merlin's had died out, and knelt by Merlin. He proceeded to rip the hem of his own red tunic into a sizable strip and wrapped it around Merlin's arm.
"It's just a scratch," Merlin said, gritting his teeth.
Actually, the shallow cut had hurt less than the application of Arthur's improvised bandage. Thank the gods, Camelot had a real physician, and he would soon see him.
"First battle wound,"
Arthur quipped, running his hand over Merlin's shoulder in a soothing circle. Arthur was frowning, though, even if he was trying to tend to Merlin.
"Why did you risk your neck like that?"
Was Arthur joking? He'd sent him down there, hadn't he? Puzzled, Merlin turned his head just a little. Arthur was leaning down over him. The two things combined made for another awkward situation. An inch or two closer, and they might have been kissing. They were close enough as it was that Merlin could guess what Arthur had eaten for lunch.
"I had to. You said you wouldn't listen to me if I didn't," Merlin logically pointed out, though he was out of breath.
Arthur let go of him and rose swiftly, as agilely as a cat.
"And what is that?" he grunted, pointing to the blue light spear that was still innocently suspended in mid-air.
The moment Merlin realized he'd forgotten it there and that he was on the brink of discovery, he let it fade. He faked a smile.
"Nothing," he said.
Merlin would have whistled as if he had not a care in the world if he'd believed it would help with his credibility.
"I see," Arthur said, his voice a strange, gravelly thing. "In that case, I have another task for you."
"But you said—" Merlin cried out indignantly.
"Either that or I won't listen to you," Arthur spat. "That's the condition."
Merlin's jaw locked tight, but he cocked his head to signal agreement.
"In the Forest of Balor, there is a deep cave, the entrance to which is guarded by spiders that have many legs and fiery eyes. They will not allow anyone to pass them. When you get into the cavern, you will find an immense hole, which you must go down, and then there are passages. I'm sure you'll be able to find the way through the darkness, since you managed just fine in here."
Arthur gestured vaguely at the empty air.
"Gaius tells me there is a flower that grows there. It's called the Mortius flower. It'll cure all the people that the evil witch who hates my father has poisoned. Gaius is old and cannot be sent. I'd have gone after it myself, but since you're doing so well on these quests, I think I'll send you. You see, Merlin, I could not leave Camelot without knowing that my subjects were well," Arthur finished.
Merlin felt strange. One moment Arthur was helpful and kind, the sort of man Merlin dreamed he could meet and have by his side. The next he clammed up and became cold and downright cruel.
Was he trying to send Merlin to his death so that he wouldn't be pestered anymore? Merlin couldn't even begin to figure out the prince's mood swings. Anyway, Merlin still had to try and complete this quest. He was sure he could tame magical spiders pretty easily, being a good warlock after all. "If you swear this is the last insane adventure you send me on..." Arthur tensed. "You are very determined to make your master happy and to see me give my hand to him. I promise you, on my honor as a prince..." Here, Arthur's voice grew very serious, "that if you do get me the petals and leaves of the Mortius, I will announce my engagement, even if my father objects." Merlin swore that he'd get the flower. When he'd reached the top of a gentle hill, Merlin jumped off the saddle, feet tangling in the stirrups, and regained his equilibrium somewhat awkwardly. He patted his horse's withers and let it graze. Later in the afternoon, he found the entrance to the gloomy cave Arthur had talked about. Thankfully, there were no evil sorcerers around, so he manned up, drew a breath, and walked into the gloom. As Arthur had said, everything was pretty dark in here. There were numerous passages, and one could very easily get lost. A person that wasn't Merlin, or magical, that was to say, would get disoriented, but Merlin was magic and encountered no such problem. He once again called his own personal light into being and proceeded farther. He wandered on for hours, scanning the walls of rock for any trace of the flower guys had described to him the day before he left Camelot. Only tufts of grass grew from the crevices of the walls. Once he spotted a lilac flower, but soon understood it wasn't the plant he was looking for. He also thanked the stars that he hadn't spotted any trace of the blasted spiders. Gaius had drawings of them, and the nasty crawlies were not something he wished to see. He did spot them when he came onto a rocky ledge or overhanging bridge. Merlin wondered for a second if it was natural or man-made, and then arbitrarily decided that it did not matter, for right in front of him he caught sight of the little yellow flowers he'd been told to procure. The spiders chose that moment to make their presence felt. They looked very interested in Merlin, so interested that Merlin suspected they were hungering for human prey. "That would be my luck," he muttered to himself, as only a madman or a very stressed-out person would. Stressed out, won out. He hadn't been driven crazy just yet. Before the spiders could reach him, Merlin incanted a powerful spell that repulsed them. A dozen fell back, and only a score of really stubborn specimens crawled on in his direction, eyes glinting in the semi-darkness. "You mistake me for your dinner," Merlin shouted. "I am not dinner." Put out, he blasted them away. Soon they were reduced to a tangle of lifeless, spidery limbs. The beasts that had retreated seemed to have a tiny brain or some form of preservation instinct, for they conceded the field to Merlin. "That should teach you," Merlin crowed, concentrating on the little bunch of flowers defiantly growing out of the rocky outcrop up and above. Merlin intoned another incantation. The flowers floated right into his hands, roots missing. Well, he did have the petals, stem, and leaves. He hoped Arthur wouldn't send him back for the roots. Both elated and unaccountably sad, Merlin walked back out the way he'd come. He'd just climbed out of the aperture that led inside the cave's depths when he was attacked from behind by a spider that was larger than any of its associates. Not being able to discriminate as to its sex now that he was in danger, Merlin surmised that it was either the mum or dad of the little spiders. Merlin was wounded in the calf during that first attack. He stumbled into the clearing, limping and cursing, trying to fend the parent spider off. Parent spider, though, was looming large over him, and Merlin felt faint with both fear and blood loss.
He closed his eyes for a moment, and when he reopened them, he found that the super-angry spider had inched far too close and was about to round on him to kill. "Drat," he thought, but did not say, because his vocal cords had frozen. He was saved by another creature's intervention. It looked like a huge, winged werecat. It had shiny black fur and large, pointy whiskers. It landed on the spider and killed it by stabbing it with its sharp claws 3 times. The spider jerked, twitched, and died not a minute too soon. When it was over, the wild winged cat turned around and fixed its gaze on Merlin, who was not afraid because he recognized Freya. "Thanks," he grinned. Freya loped closer, licked Merlin's face and his wound, cleaning it, and purred when Merlin petted her, scratching her between her pointy ears. Salutations over, Freya studied him wistfully once again, mewled ferally, and flew away. Merlin got back to Camelot very, very late the next day. When Arthur saw the flower Merlin had fought for and bled for, he did not look happy. That was a common feeling floating around, it would seem, as Merlin wasn't satisfied either. He was proud of his achievements, but not happy in the least. Neither was Uther when he heard of his son's resolution to accept Malgwyn's proposal of marriage. He fought with his son and kept him shut up in his chambers for 2 whole days before he capitulated. Naturally, Uther Pendragon was never told of Merlin's efforts, or the pact subsisting between his son and the ambassador from Dyfed. As we said, he eventually accepted his son's decision, especially when he considered the number of men Maelgwyn could levy and the strategic position of many of his strongholds. The night before the journey to Dyfed was to take place, Arthur asked of Merlin, "Is there anything else? Anything at all you want to tell me, or that you want me to know?" Arthur looked expectant and nervous. His eyes were clear and honest, and for once Merlin saw no posturing in him. It was touching, and it made Merlin's heart beat out of rhythm. Merlin had loads of things to confess, loads of them. He wanted to say, "I don't even know why, but I love you." He wanted to say, "I don't want you to marry that pompous clotpoll that is my king. I want you to choose me." But he thought of his mother, her safety, and the fact that Arthur, who'd been raised by Uther, would hate him if he learnt he was magic. Merlin dipped his head so as to shade his eyes, which he was afraid would tell the tale, and said, "No, I wish you all the happiness in the world, if it counts." "It doesn't," Arthur snapped. "Why would I care about a commoner's well wishes? Go away. You've had what you wanted." Merlin went with his tail between his legs. He did not catch a wink of sleep that night, rose tired and bleary-eyed to get on the carriage he was to share with Arthur. The journey towards Dyfed itself was a long, tedious, and silent affair. Arthur chose not to talk to him for the duration. Merlin sulked in the background and felt as if he was about to snap all the time. In the end, he settled for napping a little. At least if he was sleeping, he wouldn't be thinking, and he wouldn't feel miserable. When he woke up again, somewhere near an inn they were supposed to stay in for the night, Merlin found someone had thought of him and draped a blanket over his slumbering form. Could it have been Arthur, who was now nowhere to be seen? Merlin hoped it had been. Merlin hoped Arthur liked him enough to do that, but he soon chided himself. Surely it had been some member of the prince's retinue that had taken pity on weary, battered Merlin, and not Arthur himself. Arthur had to hate him now, if for no other reason than because Merlin had forced his hand more than a little. Merlin had nightmares that night, and felt sick on the road the next day.
Arthur was mollified when he realized Merlin was very green about the gills, and he consented to an extra stop on the road, near a clearing, during which Merlin napped, ate something, and attempted not to brood. Arthur had gone off somewhere else, to hunt rabbits, so he said. Apart from mentioning hunting rabbits and the occasional waspish retort, Arthur had not addressed Merlin at all, as if Merlin was below his notice. That had hurt more than the sarcasm and the jeering, because when Arthur was picking on him, he was at least acknowledging Merlin as a human being. Arthur's silence and distance made Merlin morose, to the point where even his magic rebelled a little, wanting to burst forth at any opportunity. He had to keep it under a tight leash, at least until they reached the border. His trials were over when they reached Dyfed a few days later. Merlin was welcomed with a pat on the back by his king and awarded a holiday because he'd done so well. Arthur was carted inside the castle, where Melguin lavished all sorts of presents on him. That was the general gossip. Merlin could not have sworn to it because he hadn't been invited to any of the banquets and displays that Melguin had ordered for his future partner. Merlin, miracle performed, had not been granted an audience and was therefore neglected. Not even his magical services were requested. Merlin felt angry and ostracized, but tried not to waste his time on useless ruminations. He tried to hone his magical skills as a productive way to spend his now copious amounts of free time. In the same way, by word of mouth, that was, he came to know of the day of the wedding and the preparations for it. Arthur was seen by the general populace, waving and nodding from the castle's grand balcony.
"He's so handsome! He'll make an excellent king consort."
"He's really Goldilocks."
"He looked depressed to me, the ungrateful man. Our king is honoring him in every way possible, and Prince Arthur never cracks a smile."
"He must be nervous. Premarital jitters." "Maybe he had to give up his sweetheart for a political marriage?"
That was the tenor of the rumors Merlin overheard. It wasn't as if he wanted to find out about those things. He didn't want to suffer and was trying to forget about Arthur, but the Prince of Camelot's name was on everybody's lips, and the wedding itself had come to be considered the event of the decade. Arthur here, Arthur there. How the king would be lucky to bed such a fine stud. Merlin had seethed over that one, because, prat or no, Arthur Pendragon was more than his looks and his lineage combined. He did have the courage of a lion, if little wisdom to temper it, and he knew how to be a good leader, a firm ruler. The day came, the day Merlin would have to bid goodbye to every dream of... The day Merlin would have to bid goodbye to every dream of Arthur he'd ever entertained came. Merlin was no coward, so he chose to attend the ceremony. He even dressed well, as if he meant to engage in the festivities, which he didn't, really, but he didn't want people to notice if he gave it a miss. Defection would stand out. He meant to get drunk as a sailor once the vows were spoken, though. Nobody said he had to be in his right mind. Towards mid-morning, he sat on a bench that had been prepared for the guests. As official court wizard, he'd been accorded a third-row seat, just behind the King of Dyfed's relatives. Not that he had ever wished to be so near the officiating personnel or the soon-to-be-wedded couple. Trumpets sounded, drums rolled, and Arthur and the King of Dyfed marched up to the spot where the Lord Chamberlain, who would be marrying them, was standing. Arthur and the King of Dyfed passed a crowd of gaudily dressed onlookers on their way up to the dais that had been erected for them. The crowd oohed and awed. The King of Dyfed, wrapped in an ermine cloak, looked stunning. But it was Arthur, predictably, who stole Merlin's breath away.
He'd always looked fine, but splendor suited him in a way Merlin had no words for. The audience clapped. Melgwyn's sister, the Lady Muriel, a beautiful but flighty woman, cried Rivers. Her cousin sniffled and blew her beak of a nose.
"We are gathered here to celebrate a wedding and a political union," the Lord Chamberlain began, thespian-like voice echoing throughout the grand ceremonial chamber. "Between Melgwyn, King of Dyfed, and Arthur Pendragon, heir to the throne of Camelot." Silence descended in the room. Melgwyn nodded, and so did Arthur, though stiffly. "This is a hand-fasting ceremony, so unite your hands before this congregation and repeat after me," the Chamberlain said in a stiff, droning voice. Arthur and Melgwyn joined their hands for everybody to see, and the Lord Chamberlain put his hand on top of theirs. "Say after me, I, Melgwyn, take Arthur Pendragon as my partner. I vow to respect him and be loyal to him. I vow to share my titles and lands with him, as I vow to share my house and riches. From this day forward, I'll look upon no other person as the companion of my days, and will consider myself solemnly bound to him in body and soul." Melgwyn repeated the words quickly and without a glitch. Merlin, who had been standing, same as all the other members of the audience, as the ritual's rules required, felt his legs fail him. He swayed and regained his seat before he could tumble down in an ungainly heap. He did not want to listen to Arthur's vows. He did not want to know whether Arthur chose to speak the vows of Camelot or Dyfed, or some he'd written himself. Blood was roaring in Merlin's ears, and his magic got out of his control, as it often did when he was feeling particularly emotional. In a quick succession, a column crashed to the ground. The pretty wig on a lady's head caught fire and had to be put out, and a vase shattered of its own volition. Arthur, who'd begun to speak the words of the ritual, and had got to the "from this day forward all" part, whirled around and focused upon a furiously blushing, irretrievably heartbroken Merlin. Merlin smiled at him sadly, encouragingly. He knew he was teary-eyed and must have looked pathetic, but he did not want to ruin Arthur's marriage for him, truly. This had to be a pleasant day for him. Melgwyn could turn into an amoeba as far as Merlin was concerned, but Arthur, for all his prattishness, deserved far better. Merlin climbed unsteadily to his feet, having decided not to stay to hear the final words that would bind Arthur to that other man. Then Merlin witnessed the impossible. Arthur snatched his hand back from Melgwyn, strode down the aisle, hand on his sword hilt and a very determined air about him, and reached Merlin. He grabbed him by the scruff of his neck and said huskily, "Little liar, idiot, warlock, it's you I want to marry." The mask of reserve Arthur always wore melted. His features softened and he smiled brightly, and not just one of those half-things that sometimes graced his lips, but a full-blown, honest, even self-deprecating smile, as if he was laughing at himself for how vulnerable he appeared. He looked at Merlin, devoured him, and his eyes gave it all away, making Merlin believe that Arthur really wanted him, the way Arthur would not lower his eyes but let a faint trace of pink stain his cheeks when he normally kept himself in check, was breathtaking. There was a moment when Arthur seemed to be finding the whole thing a little humorous, himself and the figure he was cutting, but he was trying to convey his feelings, and Merlin appreciated that. His way of trying was even more interesting. Arthur Pendragon kissed Merlin. Arthur Pendragon kissed Merlin sweetly, passionately, hungrily, filthily.
all those things were expressed in a single kiss. Arthur's soft lips and naughty tongue played havoc with Merlin's heart and made him happy. It rained rainbows and petals and sweetmeats. Melguin roared in the background. The crowd booed. And Merlin kissed Arthur back, not afraid of staking his claim. When they parted, lips feeling nicely tingly and abused, Merlin asked, "I thought you disliked me and that you set me all those tasks." "I thought you'd fallen for Melguin, and those tasks were so you would have time to stay with me and fall for me instead. You idiot warlock. I knew you were magic and wouldn't die. I wanted you for myself, and I certainly didn't want Melguin. I bought time as best I could."
"Hey," Melguin thundered, "it's me you're insulting, Pendragon."
Melguin brought his hand to the hilt of his sword, ready to draw it to defend his offended honor. He stepped down off the dais and advanced menacingly, provoking gasps. However, the chamberlain scuttled after him and laid a cautious hand on the king's elbow.
"My liege," he argued in a tremulous tone, "think of diplomacy, think of the witnesses, and the honor of your lofty name and household."
Melguin was still very red in the face, but he stopped in his tracks, scanning the faces of the assembled guests, let go of his scabbard, and reluctantly subsided. Not caring about the charade going on, Merlin asked Arthur, "You knew I was magic?"
"Blue light spears, Merlin."
"Ah."
"Yes, ah."
Another kiss, roving hands, a bite on the neck that would bruise the next day.
"I say we move it somewhere else before Melguin kills us?"
"No, not yet," Arthur said in his best seductive voice. "There's a marriage to be celebrated.
Ours."
The marriage was celebrated. The chamberlain was responsible for public ceremonies and could not refuse to officiate one between two willing adults. It would have gone against the laws of the realm. Two witnesses were forced to stand by as Merlin pledged himself to Arthur Pendragon, and vice versa. Merlin and Arthur's wedding night was spent in an inn, on the road, for both had been exiled from Dyfed on pain of death, maybe as much for their own impromptu marriage as because of the fact that Melguin had been ditched. Their first night together was well worth all the uproar. It was fireworks and magic. Merlin would know. He was a magic expert. They learned how to please one another, and they found they were passionate when it came to sharing kisses and caresses, nips and love bites and everything else a body could give, how it could yield, make one moan or roar or laugh. Merlin showed Arthur his magic, and Arthur showed Merlin how much he wanted him. It was mutual. It was a little spectacular, and they didn't leave the inn bed for two consecutive days, till one morning when they realized they would have to face the world. Arthur bestowed a kiss on the nape of Merlin's neck, gathering his sleepy, nude form to him, and mumbled, "We need to get back to Camelot. Father must know by now that the marriage fell through."
"Do we have to?" Merlin slurred.
Arthur hugged Merlin, bent down to kiss the corner of his lips, and answered, "Yes, though I suppose we could postpone the journey by an hour or two." Arthur's hands roved down Merlin's thigh, and one thing led to another, so that it was late afternoon by the time they were packed and ready to go. Uther was furious when he learned the news, but since he couldn't plot to assassinate his son-in-law, he came to grudgingly accept the status quo. He never found out that Merlin was a warlock, so he only felt degraded when he found his son had chosen a commoner, which drove him mad, but not as much as the magic tidbit would have. Húnith stayed on in Ealdor,
but she was protected from all retaliation from Dyfed by a group of trusty Camelot knights who made it their lives' task to guard her. Melgwyn married another lady, Vivian, who was a princess in her own right and disturbingly as blonde as Arthur was, and as spoiled as Arthur had once been. Melgwyn still felt bitter about the humiliation he'd undergone, however. From that day forward, he swore that Goldilocks wasn't as handsome as he was famed to be, and quite rude to boot. "The Pendragons," he quoth, "they're all upstarts." Morgana gloried in the fact that Arthur hadn't married a neighboring king, and favored Merlin because she found she had quite a few things in common with him, magic being one, and a love for teasing Arthur another. Uther, who'd never liked the other king, felt that matters could have been worse generally, but persisted in looking daggers at Merlin all the time, as if by glaring long enough he could make him disappear. Gwen felt sorry for everybody, even for the man dumped at the altar, but she found her happiness with a handsome, heroic, commoner-turned-knight named Lancelot, and she soon forgot about Melgwyn. Gaius found out that Merlin was Huneth's son, a woman he'd protected and instructed in his younger days, and as a consequence he and Merlin grew quite close and spent long afternoons playing chess and discussing magic. The dragon in the dungeons was delighted, too. He hoped that when Uther died, Merlin, who was a creature of magic like him, would free him. As a result, they all lived happily ever after. The End.